Welcome back to Nothing But the Truth. I'm your host, Trudy Stern, and I'm honored to have Michael Duran back with us today. The last time Mike was on, we were witnessing the fall of Assad and the emergence of a new regime in Syria led by al-Jolani. Together, we unpacked those seismic events and what they meant for the region and beyond. But since then, so much more has happened. The geopolitical landscape continues to shift at a breathtaking pace. And today we have a lot to delve into. Our returning guest, Mike Duran, is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, where he specializes in Mideast security issues and US foreign policy. He's a widely respected author, political commentator, and co-host of the Counterbalance podcast. With his deep expertise in strategic affairs, Mike has advised world leaders and regularly appears on major networks to analyze the complexities of global geopolitics. From Syria's shifting leadership and its impact on Israel and the broader Mideast to the evolving role of the US in the region, there's no one better to help us make sense of these dramatic developments. So let's get straight to it. Mike Duran, welcome back to Nothing But the Truth.
Well, thank you, Trudy. Great to be here.
So there's so much to delve into. Firstly, let's just start right out with the ceasefire that has just ended between Hamas and Israel. And give us your thoughts and expertise on what's happening.
So the government, the Israeli government, is in a little bit of a dilemma in Gaza because the hostages, there's still about 24 live hostages in Gaza, and we know from the reports of the hostages who were released as part of the deal that the president's special envoy brokered just around the time of the inauguration, that those hostages are not doing so well. They're being mistreated, starved, and that's, you know, there's always been a tremendous emotional feeling inside Israel about the hostages, but that activated it even more. And so there's a strong desire to get in the Israeli society to get a deal that can release the hostages. But Hamas understands that if it releases the hostages, that's going to be the end of Hamas, that it's survival. It's going to try to use this hostages in order to get a deal that will allow it to survive. So Prime Minister Netanyahu is, I think, trying to get a deal to release more, if not all of the hostages, but also signaling to Hamas that Israel doesn't have infinite patience. Israel has opened up attacks now, and they are, for the first time, they're going after the civilian leadership of Hamas in order to dismantle the civilian leadership so that they can begin the process of creating some kind of alternative there. So it's meant to be a signal to Hamas that from the Israeli point of view, there is no alternative but for Hamas eventually to surrender. And if they want to survive, they have to release the hostages. And from Hamas's point of view, they're going to try to hold out as long as possible.
What do you mean by civilian leaders of Hamas?
You have the guys who are actually carrying guns, firing weapons, carrying guns, and then you have the guys who are not carrying guns but are doing other things like controlling the aid. This is the most important thing that Israel has to do in order to dislodge Hamas as the governing authority in Gaza, is it has to take the aid distribution away from Hamas. The previous Israeli chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, he was reluctant to target the kinds of people that were performing functions like that, like delivering the aid. There now the this the new chief of staff, especially because there's a new president in Washington who is not putting as much pressure on Israel about this kind of thing, has started to target Hamas differently.
I also read that that Bibi Netanyahu said that if one hostage is killed, you know, because of this, then they were going to kill like 50 or 100 prisoners in Israel. Did you see that? Is that really?
I actually missed that statement. That would surprise me if they carried that out, just because of the way Israel functions and so on. But I didn't see that statement, so I can't really comment on it.
Oh, I didn't think it would do very much, because I don't think they really care about death of their people. So it wouldn't have been an incentive.
No, it's not. Those kinds of calculations are, as you say, they don't really work that well with Hamas, because Hamas doesn't care. I mean, what other governing authority in the world could bring this kind of destruction on their own people and still remain in power?
Really, really unbelievable monsters. Do you see any conclusion on the horizon for this war with Hamas?
Not immediately. I have no doubt that Israel is eventually going to win. If by win we mean that Hamas no longer is the governing authority in Gaza. But I wouldn't want to predict how long that is going to happen. You know, I have a record of bad predictions on your show. I think generally I'm pretty good at predicting compared to other people. But my record on your show has not been good. I think a couple of days before Assad fell, I said he wasn't going to fall. So so I'm going to be careful. I wouldn't, you know, back when the whole war began on October 7th, if you'd have asked me, will Hamas still be in power today, in March of 2025, I would have said no. I would have said it'd be gone by now. So I don't want to predict.
Before we move on to the next topic, just one last final question I have. So President Trump's comments about if the hostages aren't released, all hell will break loose. So he made those comments couple of weeks ago. First of all, what could he mean by all hell will break loose? What could he possibly rain upon them? It hasn't happened. So are they perceiving that as a, you know, an empty threat? Are they afraid about that? Or do they-
you know, I think it's a classic Trumpian statement where, for example, you know, Trump numbers, when Trump says we're going to have, you know, $100 billion, what it means is a lot of money. Basically, what I take that statement to mean, the United States is not going to be letting all hell break loose. It's the Israelis. What he means is that he's not going to restrict the Israelis. But the Israel and the Israeli, from the American point of view, the Israelis can do what they think they need to do. And that's what's happened here. The Israeli government made a point of saying that they had cleared this with the Americans before they did it. He's not going to tie the hands of the Israelis, but the Israeli hands are tied by the, because of the, not tied, but the Israelis are restricted in what they will allow themselves to do, if for no other reason than they're worried about the fate of the hostages.
Really is such a difficult position, you know, that we're all, you know, that Israel has put in. And I am really surprised that Idan Alexander has not been released, that it seems to me that Hamas could have released this last American hostage and gotten a little bit of favor.
I agree. A little bit of goodwill in Washington. If you'd have asked me on your show, I would have predicted that they would do that, actually. But it just shows you the danger of this kind of putting yourself in their position. You have to try to do that, but it's hard to think like them, because they don't care about a lot of things that we naturally care about.
So moving on to our next topic, which is Yemen and what America has just unleashed in Yemen because of the Houthis. So tell us about what's going on there and what we see.
Trudy, I think this is the best sign that we've seen out of the Trump administration since the president came into office.
Why?
For a couple of reasons. Okay, because it's the simple answer to the question why is that because it signals a completely different policy toward Iran. In the previous administration, the Biden team, they framed the conflict in Gaza from the beginning as a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And it never was, because on October 8th, one day after Hamas attacked Israel, Hezbollah opened up the front in the north in response to nothing. There was no provocation, no attack by Israel against Hezbollah. Hezbollah, of course, is part of Iran's network. So it became an Iranian-Israeli war on October 8th. And it was really an Iranian war against the United States to undermine the American order. But the Biden team always defined it as a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Iran created this ring of fire around Israel, and the Iranian diplomats told the Americans that that fire will end when there's a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. But until then, we're going to, you know, all of these other elements are going to attack. They signaled it. The Iranians always play like they have no control over Hezbollah, no control over the Houthis. But of course, this is nonsense. But the Biden administration focused on getting a ceasefire in Gaza in the hopes of having quiet around the region through that channel. And they were very careful all throughout the conflict not to attack Iran directly. They strongly pressured the Israelis to avoid any escalation that would draw Iran in further. That meant not escalating in Lebanon against Nasrallah and so forth, and it meant not attacking Iran directly. And in addition to that, the Americans would not target Iranians when American forces were attacked. And the Houthis have been the main instrument, not the only one, but the main one through which the Iranians have been attacking Americans. And the United States wouldn't escalate against Iran at all, wouldn't attack an Iranian for this, but secondly, would not even escalate against the Houthis. So the rules of engagement that our forces had against the Houthis were incredibly restrictive. So they could only attack weapons that were on the launchers ready to attack our forces with. So purely defensive, purely reactive. This is a total change. This is a total change. Trump came in, number one, he put the Houthis back on the terror list after Biden had taken them off. Number two, they've got new rules of engagement against the Houthis. These are preemptive attacks, going after Houthi leadership, going after weapons stockpiles, and they have made it clear that they're going to continue to grind down the capabilities of the Houthis over time. This isn't just a single event. This is going to be the first of many such events. But then finally, Trudy, and the most important thing of all was this Truth Social posting that Donald Trump put out yesterday, where he said, we're going to hold Iran directly responsible for what Iran does through its proxies, the Houthis. And that's a message both about what we're not going to tolerate the Houthis any longer. What they're doing, which has been, amazingly, our tolerance has been amazing, given that the United States historically has worked to keep sea lanes open. But it's also a message to Iran about its nuclear program, because over the weekend, Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, said the policy of the United States is to dismantle Iran's nuclear weapons program, lock, stock, and barrel. And this new aggressiveness of the United States toward the Houthis is a signal to Tehran. Tehran, we mean business, and we're gonna take apart your nuclear program.
And how are they going to do that?
Well, that remains to be seen. That of course is the $64,000 question. And you always have to watch things carefully, because Trump will make big statements and then he'll back away from them later on. You know, remember Gaza Lago, we're going to have the Riviera on the Mediterranean. And I don't think anyone has seen a plan to achieve Gaza Lago. It may yet materialize. It may not. So now we're hearing about destroying the Iranian nuclear program, but the Iranians would clearly like to get into a negotiation, and Trump would like to negotiate. Trump would much prefer to negotiate the end of the Iranian nuclear program than to have major military action against it. So we have to wait and see how he implements this policy. But this is a good sign, I think, with the Houthis.
So the Houthis, how are they even to be taken out? They're deep, deep, deep down in caves below rocks. I mean, is it realistic to think that we could take them out?
I think, of course, we can. It won't be easy, but there isn't a human political organization anywhere in existence that can't be hurt and degraded over time. Obviously, they have some geographic advantages. They're hard to get to. And they're very resilient, and they're very tough, and they regard themselves as very tough. You know, when they talk among themselves, they regard Hezbollah as a bunch of wussies. You know, they're the real deal.
how much do you think that America will rely upon Israel with regard to taking out these nuclear sites in Iran? Iran is clearly the biggest threat to Israel, and I think the biggest threat to the West that we have. How much leverage do you think that America will give to Israel?
I really can't answer. That's also the other $64,000 question. The Israelis, they would prefer that the Americans do it by themselves. If necessary, the Israelis would like to do it together, or if possible, they'd like to do it together with the Americans. If the Israelis have to do it alone, it's a lot harder for them to do the job completely because of capabilities and so on. If the United States transferred capabilities to Israel, deep penetrating bombs and so on that can get to the hardened sites, that would help a lot, but the United States can bring a lot more to the fight than Israel can.
So, in terms of the geographic location, also, is that a difficulty for Israel to be able to take out the sites?
No, Israel has shown that it can reach any through the attacks that it carried out on Iran. It can hit any site with impunity in Iran. That's not a problem. It's just a matter of the Iranians have dispersed their capabilities all around the country. It's the number of sites and how deeply buried they are. But also, sorry to interrupt. Also, it's the question of Iran, if only Israel attacks Iran, Iran will have certain avenues of recourse that will make life more difficult for Israel. For example, they could start attacking the Saudis and the UAE and widen the front. They threatened in the past, last October, they were threatening that if Israel attacked, they would widen the front. And so the Israelis need the Americans to step in and contain the front so that it is just an Iranian-Israel war and that Iran will not expand the conflict. So they need the Americans to deter Iran from attacking other parties. And of course, we know the Iranians, if Israel hits Iran, Iran is going to respond with more ballistic missile barrages like we saw in April and October. And for that, Israel needs the United States for the missile defenses against Iran. So Israel's going to be very reluctant to go it alone without an American okay, because it needs America on the defense.
Do you think that the reason that these talks between, you know, between Ukraine and Russia were moved over to Saudi Arabia, do you think giving Saudi Arabia this type of importance is showing that America is working with Saudi with this whole Iranian problem as well?
I would have agreed with your statement up until you said with this Iranian problem. No Saudi government is going to work directly with the United States on an offensive campaign against Iran unless they get a guarantee from the president that he is going to end this Iranian regime on his watch. This is the problem that you have with any local actor. Trudy, it'd be like me. Let's say I'm in a conflict with your local, with your neighbor. And I say, you know, Trudy, why don't you go over and break your neighbor's windows for me? But then I move away, and you're left there living next to your neighbor. So you're going to be reluctant to go escalate with me against your neighbor when you know that in the end, you're going to be the one living there forever and I might just disappear.
So you think Saudi is looking for some guarantees before getting involved?
Absolutely, and they would have to be ironclad personal guarantees from Donald Trump that he's going to actually take down this regime in Iran on his watch, and I doubt he would give such a guarantee. So all the Gulf states are going to kind of sit on the fence a little bit until otherwise.
So for all of our listeners or any of them who are joining late, we are here with Mike Duran, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, specializing in Mideast security issues and U.S. foreign policy. So I want to talk about another interesting thing right now, Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan was a relatively little known entity to many people, yet it has emerged as a significant player in the region. Its strategic location, bordering both Iran and Russia, and it has a strong partnership with Israel, makes it a very interesting and important country. So how does Azerbaijan's role influence the broader Middle East political landscape?
So thank you, Trudy. That is my absolute favorite question. I love Azerbaijan. I think Azerbaijan is a phenomenal country. I've been there many times since 2020. I was there for their victory over Armenia in the Second Karabakh War in 2020. They're a very good ally. They're one of Israel's best allies. And a lot of Israel supporters in the United States are not all that aware of that fact. Israel gets something like 2/3 of its oil thanks to Azerbaijan. It gets about 1/3 of its oil directly from Azerbaijan, but then Israel's second biggest supplier of oil is Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan's oil can't get to Israel except through Azerbaijan. So Azerbaijan is either directly or indirectly supplying Israel with a lot of its oil. Azerbaijan has done a number of things. I'm told, without being able to go into specific details, Azerbaijan did a couple of amazing things for Israel during the war. Including, by the way, supplying it with extra oil at a moment when its supply was endangered. Israel's actually a pretty easy country to embargo with respect to oil. And the Azerbaijanis at a key moment showed up with an extra tanker, not from their own supplies, but because SOCAR, the Azerbaijani energy company, has lots of friendship deals with other energy companies around the world. So they brought a tanker to, did a swap and brought a tanker to Israel at a crucial moment. But they've also done other things that have direct military relevance for the Israelis. They are a Muslim majority country. They are Shiite, right next to Iran. They represent a completely different kind of relationship between state and religion. And they're very interesting for that reason. The state in Azerbaijan is totally secular. The majority of people are, as I say, Shiite Muslims, but the state is secular. There's a large Jewish community in Azerbaijan, which is treated by the Azerbaijani people and the state as full-fledged Azerbaijanis. So you can walk around with a kippah on in the streets of Baku, and you're safer than you are walking down the streets of Paris, which is really remarkable in that regard.
What's the relationship between Azerbaijan and Iran?
Oh,
they're bordering. They have a border.
So as you mentioned, Azerbaijan borders both Russia and Iran, and it's the only country in the world that does so. The Iranians, we always say that the Iranians are Persian, but it's not actually true. One third, listen to that number, one third of all Iranians are Azerbaijanis ethnically. As the stature of Azerbaijan, which is a country of about 10 million people, as it grows internationally, as it won its war against Armenia and so on, it's having a cultural impact inside Iran. You know, you'll often see about these polls that say that Israel and Netanyahu are very popular inside Iran among Iranians. That's partly because Iranians hate their own government, but it's also because a big chunk of Iranians are Azerbaijani ethnically, and they take their cues to a certain extent from the government of Azerbaijan. They are the ethnic Azerbaijanis are concentrated in the northwest quadrant of Iran. Tabriz is the city that is the capital of Azerbaijani Iran. In Tehran, they live in fear that there may one day be an ethnic separatist movement among Azerbaijanis to join up with Azerbaijan. So relations between Azerbaijan and Iran are very tense. For that reason, they pretend, you know, the Iranians send when there's diplomatic interaction between the two countries, the Iranians always talk about their beloved brothers, the Azerbaijanis, and so on. But beneath the surface, everybody knows that is just diplomatic niceties, and that beneath the surface, there's a lot of hostility. Iran actually supports the Islamic Republic is a strong supporter of Armenia against Azerbaijan. Armenia and Azerbaijan are historic enemies, although they're on the cusp of an historic peace agreement between the two. But historically, Tehran has supported the Christian Armenia against Shiite Muslim Azerbaijan. They do this just to make life a little bit more complex for us in trying to figure out what's going on, who's against who in the Middle East.
Do you think that they get a very bad rep? I mean, Azerbaijan is not thought of well in our country because of this Armenia.
Totally. They get a horrible rap, which they don't deserve at all. They should be a very close ally of the United States. If you think of the world geostrategically right now, if you think that the United States is in competition with China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, well, then what would you want in that context? You would want the countries of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, that is resource-rich countries of Central Asia that are sandwiched between Russia and China. You would want them to have as much autonomy from Russia and China as possible. Well, if you're sitting in Moscow and you look at Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, then you realize that they cannot deliver their oil, their gas, their critical minerals to the West without going through Russia or Iran, unless they go through Azerbaijan. So in other words, Azerbaijan is the cork, from Moscow's point of view, it's the cork in the bottle of Central Asia. The goal of the United States should be to open up Central Asia. So we should be helping Azerbaijan to bring resources from the from Central Asia to Europe. Turkmenistan, right across the Caspian Sea from Azerbaijan, is the fourth largest, natural gas reserves of any country in the world. So if those natural gas reserves went across the Caspian through Azerbaijan, through the pipeline that Azerbaijan has already created to Europe, then there would be enough gas to give Europe energy independence, gas independence from the Russians, which should be an American national security objective. This would be relatively easy to effect, but we would have to reassure the Turkmens that they won't be attacked by Iran or Russia if they do this. That requires the United States. It also requires the Turks. One last thing, the Azerbaijanis are also get a lot of criticism because they are the little brothers of the Turks. Turkey and Azerbaijan are strategic allies, very close. They have a very, very close alliance. One of the ways that Azerbaijan was able to elbow out the Russians and the Iranians and maintain its independence from the two of them, even though it has a border with both of those countries, is that it relies on Turkey as a counterbalance to Russia and Iran. So the Azerbaijanis are the little brother of the Turks and the best friend of the Israelis, and that makes them a very interesting country.
Do you see the sentiment in Washington changing towards the Azerbaijanis?
There has been a shift. There has been a shift in the last few months. I don't know exactly what caused it, but I see much more positive press, and I see people starting to wake up and see some of these things that I've been talking about, like the importance of Azerbaijan for American security in Central Asia. I think part of it is the administration. I'm speculating here, but I think Donald Trump sees, you know, Donald Trump actually wants to go down in history as a peacemaker. And I think he sees Azerbaijan and Armenia right on the cusp of a peace agreement. And he would like to have that happen on his watch. That might be one of the reasons why people are waking up. I'm not really sure. Pashinyan, the leader of Armenia, he was in Washington about a month ago. And he made it really clear. I mean, almost he basically said it openly that the Armenian lobby in the United States is, against peace, against him. It's basically, an arm of Russian propaganda in this country, because Armenia is a satellite of Russia. It's an ally of Iran, and it's a satellite of Russia. If you're in an airplane over Armenia and you radio down to the ground to somebody on the ground in Armenia, you're talking to a Russian, not to an Armenian speaking Russian, to an actual Russian, because the Armenians have given over their airspace to the Russians. Russia has three military bases. The commanding heights of the Armenian economy are all run by the Russians. So Putin doesn't like the way Pashinyan, the Armenian leader, is moving in the direction of a peace agreement. I mean, I think he's actually accepted it, but he liked it better when there was this perpetual conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, because he could then hold the balance and hope that he could retain Russia's traditional position of dominance in the South Caucasus.
Does Azerbaijan have a relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Sure. Yeah, they have relations with everyone.
Do they have a good relationship with Arabia?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They have to be careful. Because they maintain correct relations with Iran, and even better than correct relations with Putin, because they do border these countries. They have to be careful of not provoking them. They are only a country of 10 million people and very vulnerable. So they try to maintain relations with everyone. But they make once they are your ally. They are absolutely open about it. The Israelis have been shocked by the willingness of the Azerbaijanis as a Muslim majority country to openly speak with pride about their relationship with Israel. They don't hide it. Once they decide that they have made a strategic decision to be your ally, you can count on them more than you can count on your own family.
It's remarkable that they're able to get away with that they can get away with being an ally of Israel and also not an enemy of Iran and Russia.
And a friend and a close, you know, basically a relative of Turkey. The Turkish that's spoken in Azerbaijan is mutually intelligible with Turkish. You know, Azerbaijan is starting to play a role in Syria that's very interesting. They're in Syria. Delivering aid, and they are, according to the Israeli media, they are offering to play a mediating role in Syria between Jerusalem and Ankara, which is very, very interesting. You may have noticed last week that Steve Witkoff, the president's special envoy, was in Baku, and the Israeli media reported that in Baku, he talked to the Azerbaijanis about playing this mediating role between Turkey and Israel. So we're going to hear a lot more about them. They are punching above their weight already, and I think they're going to continue to.
That's really interesting. I can't wait to have you back to see what happens with that. Just quickly for 2 minutes, because I know you have a hard stop. Let's just look at Syria for just 1 second. So al-Jalani, at last we saw him, he was shedding his, distancing himself from al-Qaeda and ISIS, rebranding himself as a peace-loving leader, wearing a suit, army fatigues off. But his recent massacre of hundreds of the Alawites and the Christians, that tells a very different story. So what do you really feel? What is the real nature here of his ambitions?
Well, I have to correct you on something you just said. There was no massacre of Christians. To my information, there were 7 Christians who were killed. And I think this is a really big deal because it spread all over social media that he was massacring Christians. And there were lots of videos of people that they were being brutalized and we were told they were Christians. It's simply not true. And that is, by the way, Russian-Iranian propaganda. Russian-Iranian-Armenian propaganda.
Why would they want to do that?
Because the Alawite community, so first of all, what happened? There was a massacre, absolutely true. I wouldn't deny that for a second, but we have to understand the context. There were on the coast and of Syria, Latakia and Tartus. These are the two above Lebanon. There are these two coastal provinces, and that is the heartland of the Alawites. The Alawites are a minority religious sect. They make up, I don't know, the books always say 12%. I don't know if it's 12%, 13%, 9%, but a relatively small fraction of the population of Syria. But they were the ruling element for the last 52 years because the Assads were Alawites. And so all of the key people around Assad were Alawites. And when Jolani took over, the Alawites left Damascus and they went over to the coast. I mean, they live in that's their ethnic heartland anyway. But I'm saying that the people in Damascus, the former leaders, military officers, they repaired to the coast. Last week, or you know, week before last, former regime elements rebelled against Shara, that's Jolani, and started attacking, ambushing government, Syrian interim government security forces. The interim government then responded by putting a call out over all the mosques of the country to the Sunni jihadis, come save the regime and fight these former regime elements. So they went to the coast, fought the former regime elements, but in the process also massacred a lot of civilians. The numbers you're seeing in the newspapers are like 1,300 people killed. It won't surprise. I have no idea what the real numbers are. It won't surprise me when it's all over if a couple of thousand Alawite civilians were massacred. It's horrible stuff. It's terrible. It's gut-wrenching to see it. But we also need to speak about these things truly and honestly about what's actually happening. We had a civil war in Syria that lasted from 2011 until last year, in which Alawites and their allies, Hezbollah and Iran and the Russians, slaughtered hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Sunni civilians, tortured, raped, slaughtered, drove millions out of the country. So the sectarian feelings are running very, very high. But this is not something new in Syria. This is something old. Now, the way that Shara dealt with it, and is not. I don't think it gave anyone in Washington, Jerusalem, or Paris, London, or Berlin, good feelings about what this portends for the future about dealing with them. But let's understand it, I think, in the proper context. From my point of view, the strategically most significant thing about those events is that the former regime elements, which are tied to Iran organically, tried to make a comeback. Trudy, we have to keep our eyes on the prize, and the prize is defeating Iran. Iran is not defeated. They're going to try to make a comeback. They're going to try to assassinate Shara. They're going to try to foment sectarian conflict there. And the minute there is, everyone is going to, the minute there's sectarian conflict, everyone is going to say, Shara is a Muslim brother backed by Erdogan trying to take over the whole Arab world with the Islamic revolution and so on. I don't like to see Americans and Israelis saying the same thing as the Iranians and the Armenians and the Russians about this sectarian business. And they were the Americans and the some Americans and some Israelis became unwitting purveyors of Iranian propaganda.
Wow, there is so much to continue discussing, but sadly, we've come to the end of our show, Mike.
We've got just enough in there so I can get hate mail from all your all your viewers about my views on that last subject. But
no, you've been so unbelievably helpful. Thank you so much for joining us. Your insights are always so invaluable. And with everything unfolding so rapidly in the Middle East and the world, we hope you'll come back again soon to help us make more sense of it. To my listeners, thank you for tuning in and being a part of this conversation. Make sure to tune in every Thursday night at 9:30 for another episode of Nothing But the Truth. If you missed any part of tonight's show or want to catch up on past episodes, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Trudy Stern. Truth matters. Freedom depends on it. Until next time, stay informed, stay vigilant, and keep seeking nothing but the truth.